You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, welcome to the Snooker Scene Podcast. I'm Dave Hendon. This week, I chat to one of the game's real gentlemen, Marco Fu. He's been a professional and mainstay of the tour for 20 years. He's won three world ranking events. He's featured at the latter stages of so many major tournaments. Marco and I sat down recently in Coventry to have a right good chat. Marco, what was your introduction to snooker? How did you get into the sport?
My father got me into it. He was a big fan of snooker and still is. Still plays every day. So he loves the game. And because back then in the 80s in Hong Kong, and used to be top class players coming to Hong Kong every year.
Yeah.
Once or twice at least, you know, playing the Queen Elizabeth Stadium. And yeah, it was just so popular back then. Everybody played snooker, and I was obviously one of the youngest customers in the snooker clubs.
Yeah.
But you always get to see it. Like you see it on the streets and you see it on TV. Mm. There's always something about snooker.
Mm.
And my dad got me into it.
Because I had a ranking event there in 1989. Did you go to that or did you see it?
No, I didn't go to that one, but I went to the previous, the exhibition ones. Because
right.
The ranking ones, just too many players, you know. They used to have like the exhibition, just an 8-man event. You used to have one or two of those every year. So I got to see Jimmy, Steve Davis, Dennis Taylor, Terry. It's just great fun.
And then you moved to Canada, didn't you, when you were young, so which was also a very strong area for snooker.
I went to Canada when I was 12. It was snooker was pretty strong still when I was there, but not as strong as it was maybe 10-8 years before that. So I still got to play a couple of professionals, ex-professionals, like Bill Werbenek, but he was he stopped playing already. Brady Cole.
You didn't have a drink with Bill, no?
I watched him drink a lot though. But it was still good practice for me back then, because I was only a kid. They give me advice, no problem. It's great to be able to play those players, and I learn a lot from them.
And so how quickly did you improve from being someone like a lot of young people who like playing to actually realizing that you were good at it and you could perhaps progress?
I think I needed to wait till when I was maybe 15-16 until I realized that snooker is probably going to be my profession, because I met some great coaches, you know, back then, and they were helped me a lot with my game. And when I first went to Canada, I was just playing basketball. I stopped playing snooker for a few years, and I picked it up again when I was 15. Then I met like some great people, and they were helping me to get to a decent amateur player, from a player that was only maybe making 50-60 break, and I was making hundreds, even maximums, in maybe 2 or 3 years' time. All those people a lot.
And so you were still a teenager when you won the world under 21, and then you won the world amateur championship.
Yeah.
So that was quite a breakthrough.
That was a great year, 1997. I went back to Hong Kong from Canada in 96. I won a couple of local tournaments, so I got a chance to represent Hong Kong to play in the IBSF events. So it was always a great experience. I was just really enjoyed the occasion, you know, representing your country, you know, playing top class snooker players. I didn't really think of winning, but yeah, I just had a good couple of months, you know. I was like potting everything, and I won two of the biggest tournaments on the amateur circuit, and that got me into the professional circuit as well.
Beat Stuart Bingham in the World Amateur Final, 11-10, I think.
Yeah, that was one of the most memorable matches for me, probably for Stuart as well, because yeah, he was 7-1 up, and I managed to come back and to win 11-10. That was my biggest achievement back then, you know, world amateur champion.
And then you turned pro, and pretty much immediately you were in a final. You got to the final of the Grand Prix in
1998,
which was pretty much your first tournament.
There was a bit of a surprise. Obviously, I was on the back of a very good run, you know, from winning the IBSF tournaments, but from amateur to pro is just two different sports, basically. So I didn't really expect to do a lot so soon. I don't think anybody expected it. So it was a bit of a surprise, but I really enjoyed it, you know, just be able to play all my idols, you know. I was watching them on TV, and all of a sudden they're right in front of me playing me. So yeah, it was just a great experience for me.
What was impressive about it was that you seemed to immediately adapt to like the TV conditions, the crowd. Like you say, you beat Ronnie O'Sullivan, you beat Peter Ebdon. Nothing seemed to faze you at all.
Yeah, back then I didn't have a lot of battle scars, and you know, I had less to lose. Everybody around me have everything to lose, so obviously I wanted to beat them. But I just wanted to go out there and just have a smile, you know, just be happy and just enjoy the experience, which I did, and I managed to play some good snooker against those players.
And then I guess, like, because you've broken through getting to the final, you got lots of people maybe back home and in the game, suddenly they're now tipping you to be like next world champion. And was that, because you've got to go and play another tournament, you've got to sort of come down to earth a bit, was it difficult having had that immediate breakthrough to then get used to being a pro?
Yeah, it was very hard. I think the first tournament wasn't that hard because I had nothing to lose, but I got to the final. It was good in a way, but also bad in a way. You know, I had some like very, very, very tough few years after that. You know, I didn't really get to another final until 2003, I think, which was a long wait. But I had a lot of ups and downs, you know, after that. And my game wasn't great, to be honest. I was just relying on a bit of instinct, bit of confidence. But overall, my game technically wasn't good enough to be in the top 32 even. But I was able to win a few matches here and there. But I was all over the place after that.
Yeah. It seems like you've always focused on your sort of technique, and coaching has been important to you, hasn't it? But I guess you've got to get used to, maybe if your style has to change, you've got to get used to that and playing like that in tournaments. Would that be right?
Yeah, I think all the youngsters, when they first turned pro, or when they started off playing, they were all out attacking.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody's the same. So, but after a few years on the professional circuit, you know that way of playing is not going to get you anywhere.
Sure.
So you've just got to change. Unless you're a fantastic potter like Mark Williams, unless you're that good, but not a lot of people are that good. They're good potters, but not that good. So you just need to rely on your safeties, your brick building, a little bit of shot selection as well. So I learned the game as I was playing in the tournament, which was kind of difficult because I had so much to learn, you know.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. So, but it was a great experience overall.
The end of your first season, you played at the Crucible. How big a deal was that? Because obviously, in this country, like British kids growing up, the Crucible is everything.
Yeah.
You know? Was it the same for you? Was it like this sort of mystical place that you suddenly there you were?
Yeah, for me it was obviously like Crucible. You watch all the great matches over the years. I think a vast majority of the classic matches were played at the Crucible.
Yeah.
So I was really looking forward to playing at the Crucible, and I didn't really think I could get there in my first season. That was a great achievement for me as well. Probably just as good as getting to the final, the first tournament, getting to the Crucible. So I really enjoyed it, but it was tough.
Yeah,
it was really tough because on TV it looks a little bit different.
Yeah.
You know, when you're actually there, I'm sure a lot of players have played there will say the same.
Yeah.
But I didn't adapt to playing at the Crucible very well.
You won your first sort of big breakthrough in terms of a title was the Premier League 2003. I guess it must have been nice just to get hands on a trophy after, like you say, that initial breakthrough, getting to a final, a lot of talk around you. Now you've won a tournament. That must have been a relief.
Yeah, a relief more than anything, because getting to the final, the first tournament that I expected, a lot more for myself after that. I expect to get to another final very soon, but I just needed to wait for another 4 or 5 years before getting to the final. But that wasn't even a ranking event, even though it was such a great event. Mm. So it's such an honour to be able to play in it. Still, it wasn't a ranking event, so it was very, very hard for me.
All top players, though, weren't they? The real cream of the crop.
Yeah, all the top players. The top four back then, and plus Steve Davis, Jimmy White, and myself. So very, very hard tournament to win. So, it was a relief and a great honour to be able to win such an exclusive event.
And then you did win your first ranking title, 2007 Grand Prix. Beat Ronnie O'Sullivan in the final, which, you know, just sort of capped it all, I guess.
Yeah, I had a pretty good record against Ronnie, you know, especially in the first half of my career. Yeah. Funny enough, I wasn't I wasn't as good as now actually back then, but I tend to beat him. I tend to play quite well
against him. Beat him in the first round of the Crucible.
Yeah, he made 147. Yeah, he made 147, and I beat him 10-5 or 10-6. So I played quite well, and I beat him. Yeah, obviously first time at the Guildhall, then Aberdeen the final. So I tend to have a pretty good record against him, but I haven't beat him for maybe 7 or 8 years now. So that was in the past.
But that was the Grand Prix, that was like the fourth BBC event in those days, so that was a high profile win, wasn't it?
I call that a major as well, even though it wasn't. But I was telling everybody it was BBC event, it was a major tournament. So I was trying to cheat a bit, but it's still a great event, the Grand Prix.
Did you feel you were due one? I mean, you were one of those names, a bit like Ryan Day's now, 1-1. Like people were saying, well, Marco is obviously good enough. When's it going to happen? And it happened that year.
Yeah, it was kind of frustrating because I got the game, even though it wasn't great, you know, but still good enough to win tournaments. But I waited for, that was my 9th season as a pro before winning the first ranking event, which was very long.
Your next one was in Australia. Maybe you weren't the most popular man there because you beat Neil Robertson in the final. But again, I guess once you've won one, you just want to win another one. I guess that's how it works.
But
took a while though, didn't it? Took a few years.
Yeah, took another few years. I had so many up and downs, you know. After the Grand Prix again, I seem to be going through a lot of changes from my career, and sometimes it can be really, really bad, you know, when I was trying to adapt some new things and. I had a lot of downs, you know, after the Grand Prix, and but Australia was just one of those weeks. I was putting everything seemed to go my way, every little nudges, you know, just I kind of needed to rely on a little bit of that, but I played quite well that week.
And then the third one you won was just last season, the Scottish Open. You played unbelievably well. You had 11 centuries. John Higgins starts the final with 3 centuries, and you beat him 9-4. I mean, that was, you played really well that week.
Yeah, I played very well. Played very well that week. I was just. When I saw the table, it was a clearance right away. So it was just one of those period, you know, in your career that that can happen, you know, sometimes. And, that was unreal, the way I played throughout the tournament. In the final, I had a bit of luck, but overall, I played very well.
I think I'm right in saying John invited you to his house for a sort of celebration.
I turned down. It was all in the paper. Next day, it wasn't very nice. But I had to catch a flight, you know, the next morning, because I got my car, so I need to drive down to Heathrow from Glasgow. So I got up at 4 o'clock. I have to get up at 4 o'clock to catch the flight. So not the best of drive, you know. I said no to John, which was a shame. I would love to go because it's Christmas time, leading up to Christmas, and he was having a party. And very nice, John. Very nice guy. He invited me to his house. I would love to go. I would love to go. But sorry.
You seem to be, Marco, a player who gets on with most of the players. Would that be correct? You don't sort of. You're not one for sort of big rivalries necessarily.
No. I don't really mix with the players a lot. You know. But they're all very nice. You know, nice people. Soccer players are overall very nice. But. But I don't drink, I don't play poker, so I don't really mix with them a lot. But I would love to, you know, know them a little bit better. But over the years, I've met many nice snooker players. So tend to get along with most of them.
Most, okay. Most. You also, you know, when we see you on television in particular, you seem to, some players show their emotions a lot and you know what they're feeling. You seem to be able to keep it in to an extent where even if you're feeling bad inside, you don't necessarily show it. Is that just how you are, or is that something you've learned?
A little bit of both, that's how I am. But also, I think I've had a lot of setbacks in snooker, so sometimes I get very disappointed when I lose. So I just said to myself, if I win next time, I'm not going to get too carried away. I'm not going to jump up and down, you know, on the table and stuff like that. Because when I get really happy after a win, then it works both ways. I get more disappointed when I lose. So I try to stay somewhere in the middle. Yeah. If I win, it's okay. Yeah. If I lose, then I'm not too gutted. I try to, because it's a hard feeling sometimes.
Yeah.
Snooker.
Yeah.
It's all in the mind. Sometimes when you lose, you go back to the hotel, or sometimes you drive home. It's very, very hard. So I just try to do something different, you know, and it seems to work a little bit for me. I felt okay, you know, throughout my career, you know, dealing with victories and setbacks. And yeah, that's the way I looked at it.
Okay. What have been the real sort of disappointments? I mean, are there certain matches, maybe even certain shots that stand out and you think, if only that had happened differently? Or
yeah, I mean, I've got so many. I mean, losing to Sean Murphy, 10-9 in the UK final, that was a tough one to take. I was 9-8 up, and I missed a great chance to win 10-8. Then the semi-final of the World Championship in 2006, 17-16 to Ebden.
Yeah.
That was another one I had a chance.
You were 15-9 down.
15-9 down, then came back 15 each, then he went 16-15, then 16 each. So that was my best chance to get into the final at the Crucible. So I had a half a chance, you know, in the last frame. He'd done a great clearance, every credit to him. But if I've taken my chance a little bit better, then I should have won. But those two are a little bit hard to take, even thinking back. A little bit hard. But
Is it hard, though, not to... In fact, it interests me, is it hard not to dwell on it? Because I interviewed Ken Doherty, and he was saying about the black he missed for the 147 at the Masters, and he still, every now and again, will replay it in his mind and he pots it, but obviously he can't change what happened, but he just can't sort of put it out of his mind. Is that how it is for players?
Yeah, sometimes but I'm not that great, you know, with my memories on the snooker table. Sometimes people will remember all the shots, you know, they play, like 2006 British Open first round frame two, they remember they miss a black flick or something like that. I'm not one of those. I just play a match, I couldn't remember a lot of shots, you know. I play, so which is kind of good, but I watch a lot on myself on YouTube and stuff like that. I try to pick up the little things. I try to look at the ones that I win, actually.
Well, that's the way to do it. So if you sort of look at YouTube of yourself, how do you compare yourself now? Because you're still obviously very much top eight player now, compared to maybe, I don't know, 10 years ago. Are you a better player now, more consistent maybe?
Yeah, overall I'm a better player, you know, better around the table. I look better around the table, and sometimes looking back, I can make a high break, but my white ball was everywhere. But now I'm kind of more in control, safety play a little bit better, shot selection a bit better. Long potting maybe not as good as back then, but overall I think I'm a better player now.
The Griffiths family have been quite important to you, Terry and and Wayne, now his son as well. But just talk about sort of how they've helped you.
I think, first I worked with Terry in 2002, I think. I went to see him in the wrong time because I just... I was really struggling with my game, and I've got a match, you know, qualify for the Crucible. I was playing Sean Murphy, but that was 3 days later. I went to see Terry, and everything about my game was wrong. So that was a wrong timing, you know, to go to see Terry. So that wasn't a great start, you know. But but after that, he changed a lot of things about my technique, you know, shortened up my bridge, my cue arm. And the backswing a little bit, because I was pulling left or right or something like that. It wasn't straight anyway. So that helped me to win the Grand Prix and get to the UK final. But I tend to have a lot of changes, you know, in my career with my technique. So, but he's definitely helped me a lot, and Wayne's the same.
Because Wayne, for people who don't know, Wayne is Terry's son, and he works in Hong Kong as well, doesn't he?
He works in Hong Kong, He started working in Hong Kong in 2010, I think, so he's been there for a long time now, and he's the coach of the Hong Kong squad, so it's the ladies, the seniors, and the juniors as well, so he works with all of us, basically, he's done a great job there.
You talk about the real big tournaments. I mean, you've been twice world semi-finalist, you've been in the Masters final, you've been in the UK final, all great achievements that a lot of players would sort of envy, but I guess having not quite won one of them yet, is that sort of next on your list of things that
obviously,
you'd like to do?
I mean, those tournaments are the toughest tournaments on the calendar to win, and the most important ones as well, so everybody will be ready, you know, to play in those tournaments. They'll practice harder before the tournament, so their standard will be higher, And the format, I think, is a little bit longer compared to most of the tournaments. So you have to be more consistent, especially the world. You need to be technically, mentally, physically, everything has to be there, which is over the 17 days as well. So that's the toughest tournament to win. Mm. Yeah, I'm kind of a little bit proud of how I've done in those Triple Crown events, but I would love to do better. Obviously, you know, not winning those tournaments, would make me feel a little, I feel I don't belong to one of the great players, obviously, without any one Triple Crown event. So I would love to win at least one before I retire.
How sort of mentally hard is the World Championship? I mean, like you say, it's not like any other tournament. Some matches last 3 days, like the semi-finals last 3 days. You played Mark Selby a couple of years ago in the semi-final, and you know it's four sessions of what you know is going to be tough snooker. How do you sort of prepare yourself for that? Because that's hard.
Yeah, that's hard, and also you just finish a very tough match before that as well. Because I think I beat Barry 13-11. So same thing earlier this year. You know, I beat Neil Robertson in the last 16, 13-11. Tough match, tough match. Took a lot out of me.
Yeah.
Then the next day I'm playing Selby and I lost easy, 13-3, 13-4, something like that. So, yeah, I think the physical part is definitely the most important, I would say. Technical is always there, but when you're physically not there, it will, play a big part, you know. It will affect your game a lot, I mean, when you're not 100% physically. So that's the most important aspect, I think.
And also, if you do, like you say, the Mark Selby match last season, if you start to go like 10-3, 11-3 down, it must be pretty demoralising. You know, you're looking at the scoreboard and do you just want it to kind of be over then, or how does it work?
Yeah, I think the way I felt and the way he played, I knew, I think, halfway through the match, I knew I don't think I can, it's highly unlikely that I will come out as a winner in that match because he was playing really well and I was only feeling maybe 30% of what it was earlier that week. So I was just very tired and, getting old maybe, but I know it's just very hard, you know, just a little embarrassing as well. So I was kind of relieved that he played very well, made all the balls, and but it's not a great feeling, especially at the Crucible.
Of course, yeah, it's very public as well, isn't it? But one thing about you, you've always looked after yourself. You're not, you know, a hellraiser in any sense. Like, say, don't drink. I guess that's important in terms of energy, and you know, if you've not been out late at night in some casino, you're going to prepare properly.
Yeah, I think that seems to be the trend, you know, in a lot of the sports. You know, they go vegan, they're on a very healthy diet, you know, and they seem to improve the game, you know, dramatically when you do that. And I'm a vegetarian, I'm not a vegan, but still, it helps a lot, you know, with my weight and, the way I feel, you know, sometimes. And I try to eat healthy and drink healthy, but sometimes that's not enough. You just need to, you know, do a little bit more. But at least I've given myself the best chance, you know, to go into a match with a very good state, you know, physically. So, that's what I try to do.
Yeah. You made, I think, 4 1-4-7s. You made the first one ever shown on the internet. If that means anything to you. And made one at the Masters. They're special, aren't they? I mean, they're still... People say they're more common, but when you make one, it's special.
Yeah, still very special. I mean, even if you make one... I think I've made one in one of the qualifiers. Again, that sale, it was only maybe 500 quid or something.
Yeah.
But still special. Yeah. Still a good feeling. Yeah.
And to make more than one as well. I mean, not many people have made one in a tournament. But you made four, so you're right at the list.
Yeah. But that's only when you one frame it. But still, very nice. You know, 1-4-7 is maybe... People don't really appreciate now with the 1-4-7, but players are getting very good. Seems to be 1-4-7 every week now. So maybe 4 1-4-7s in the last 3 weeks or something, which is amazing. But back then, not a lot of players can make 1-4-7, so it felt even better when I actually made one.
How conscious are you of representing Hong Kong? Because you must be one of Hong Kong's most successful ever sports people. You've got to be.
Not really.
No?
No. No.
Who would be above you?
Quite a few, actually.
Really?
Yeah, because I mean, it's a very tough field, you know. I don't win a lot. I mean,
you're very high profile. You know, snooker's a high profile television sport around the world.
Yeah.
And you're always kind of in the mix somewhere.
Yeah, but you just need to win, right?
Right.
You just need to win. Yeah. If I didn't turn pro and I play in IBSF events, I'll be multiple world champion. They'll say I'm multiple world champion because they can't tell the difference between IBSF and winning at the Crucible. Obviously, they know the players, or beating Ronnie and beating Selby. They know a few, but you just need to win. Just need to win. So, I mean, I'm ranked six or seven in the world, but I don't think that means a lot to them. But it doesn't matter. I just do my own things and try to get as much satisfaction as possible, you know, from winning.
Mm. You're now a father, of course, as well. So that, I guess, changes your priorities, does it? You're not just playing for yourself anymore, are you? That's well in the past.
Yeah, that's pros and cons, obviously. Mm. Sometimes when I'm a little bit more motivated, you know, going to matches, but sometimes I feel I'm always away. I'm always on the road, which is very, very hard, you know, especially when you're not playing so well. Mm. That's very, very hard for me. I'm not sure about the other players, but I tend to travel a little bit more compared to most of the players. Everybody travels a lot now, but I tend to do a little bit more than them. So, missing the birthdays, you know, missing the special moments, which is, I feel a little bit sad, actually, that way. But that's the way it is.
Snooker's quite a lonely sport, isn't it? I mean, literally, when you're out there, it's just you.
Yeah, very, very lonely, yeah. People talk about the mental side of the game, a lot of players are suffering from some mental problems, which is understandable because snooker is a very quiet sport. You know, it's not a lot going on. You know, in a match, it seems like very quiet, but inside the mind is very busy. Yeah. Everybody's going through all these emotions, positive, negative emotions. You know, it's just like a roller coaster for everybody. Even though you're just sat in a chair, but it can be very hard. You know, and when you lose, you're back on the road or you stay in your hotel on your own. So it's understandable why people are suffering from it. And so just try to. Yeah, be happy, and I just need to maybe pick and choose a few tournaments. It's very hard for me to travel all the time throughout the year, so I just need to, hopefully pick and choose a few tournaments. That's the downside, but you can't have it both ways. Just need to find a balance, I think.
Yeah, you're unlikely to be late, Marco, for a match because you've got this watch that we see. I'm looking at it now with great envy. Tell me about it. It's a limited edition watch. It's a Marco Fu watch, right?
Yeah. It's a 147 special edition. So I have.
So there's 147.
147 of them. Yeah. Right. I'm doing a bit of design work for a Hong Kong watch company. Mm. So. I think watch and snooker play, they match quite well. Mm. Like when you're playing, you know, everybody can kind of see what...
They can see yours. Sure,
yeah, they can see me from outside, I think, yeah. So, yeah, they match quite well. So the watch people are very happy, I think. Yeah, they're both accuracy, right? Accuracy very important in timing and obviously in snooker as well. So, yeah, I'm very happy to be able to have my own edition.
Yeah, and if I mean, they're probably all sold now, but if I wanted to buy one, I mean, what would I have to pay for them? How
maybe $4,000 or something.
Really?
It's a two beyond. It's like Hong Kong made two beyond. If it's made in Switzerland, then it's going to be like five times as much.
But, okay.
It's a very nice watch. And,
Well, if it's free, certainly. I also read on Wikipedia that you've been made a justice of the peace. Is that true? And what does it mean? Can you arrest me? I mean, what's
yeah, I spoke to Wayne. They said justice of peace in the UK is a little bit different.
Yeah.
In Hong Kong, I have a social responsibility. I can. Mm. Visit. I have to visit like hospitals, prisons, and just need to give the government feedbacks of what I think of the facilities. You know, public facilities, and I still haven't done any yet because I was just named not a few months ago, and I'm always on the roll. But I'm due one, I think, very soon. I need to visit different places and. Yeah. Yeah, it's a great honor. It's a great honor. So you see a lot, you know, on like Hong Kong movies, you know, the justice of peace, you know, visiting the prison, and never thought that I'll be one. You know? So great honor.
That shows, like I said, how high profile you are. You know, you've been chosen because you're recognizable, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. But still, very overwhelming, you know.
Mm.
It's just a great honor. Hopefully, I can do a good job.
Mm. You. Dare I say, you're nearly 40 now, but in snooker that's actually not in any way old these days, we know that.
Mm.
But you're not going to play forever. What's your sort of ambitions at this stage of your career? What are your sort of goals right now?
I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 years more.
Right.
After that, I'll probably still play if I can, if I'm still on the main tour, I don't know. But if I am still on the main tour, then I'll probably play a little bit.
Mm.
Maybe a few events every year, but I'm not going to worry too much about my rankings. I'll probably be like 40 and 50 in the ranking. Right. Hopefully I'll stay on the main tour, but just play for fun. But hopefully I can concentrate in the next 3 or 4 years to stay in the top of the game and see how it goes. But
And what then, after, if when your career is over, Have you given any thoughts to what you do next?
I just love snooker so much. I think the only reason I plan to retire is because of the family, you know. Yeah. Just the travelling is very hard, you know. I'll probably still do something with snooker, you know, hopefully with something to do with coaching back in Hong Kong or in China. Mm. Hong Kong's my first priority, and hopefully I can do a little bit of that. But it's very hard to start off, obviously, because I'm still traveling a lot, so I can't do anything now. But I would love to be a snooker coach.
Mm. And finally, as you sort of, your career's not over, obviously, but as you look back on it, how sort of satisfied are you? I mean, you've played in all the great venues, you've won tournaments, it's a great career. But I interviewed Stephen Hendry, and he won everything. And even he was saying, "Well, there's a couple." But he was saying, like, the world final with Ebden, picking things.
Yeah,
sure. How easy is it to be sort of satisfied with your lot, or are those sort of nagging things okay? We've only ever won that one, or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. You can always pick a hundred matches that you could have won, right? Like, over your long career. But for me, I'm not that greedy. I think thinking back the days in Canada, you know, I was losing to players like Brady Golden, for example. Yeah. He didn't really get to the top 32 in the world back then, and he was beating me a lot on a regular basis. I was maybe 15 points behind. So for me, getting to the top 32 was my goal. I've given myself like maybe 7 or 8 years to achieve that, you know, to get to the top 32. But I've done a little bit better than that over the years, I'm very more than happy, because I didn't really put in that much work, you know, compared to a lot of players. I wasn't that dedicated, so I think they deserve a little bit more success than I do, that's for sure. But overall, I'm very happy with the things I've done in the game.
That's good to hear, and it's been a pleasure to talk to you, Marco. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dave.
Cheers. Thanks. Sports Social Podcast Network.